has got to be one of only a few thousand survivors of World War II, and everyone who served. And so that's the end of the program for today. I don't know why I'm having some trouble playing the news. If I can't get the news up, I will just talk about the weather, and then we'll go on to hear about the sports guys and what they have to say.
USA Radio News with Ron Taylor.
A San Diego man is dead after shooting himself, ending a day-long standoff. Our correspondent, Randy Fuller.
Police say the 54-year-old was holed up all day yesterday in a Mission Valley hotel room with a SWAT team outside. The man had reportedly not taken care of his bill for several days and pulled a gun on an employee when he was asked to pay up. Authorities entered the room late last night and found him dead of a self-inflicted gunshot.
More federal help is on the way as wildfires rage across Southern California. President Trump declared a state of emergency for the region as crews try to stop the spread of six large wildfires that have erupted since Monday. It turns out one of Roy Moore's accusers admits she forged part of a high school yearbook inscription attributed to the Alabama Republic Senate candidate. Beverly Young Nelson claims that Moore wrote most of the message and signed the yearbook when she was just 16. Moore has flatly denied claims of sexual misconduct with teenage girls when he was in his 30s. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Hey, everyone. Proactive has an incredible offer for our listeners only. Stay tuned for a 100% risk-free offer that includes a free deep cleansing brush and free shipping. Do you have acne or even the occasional breakout? With Prescription Strength Proactive, your acne can heal and you can prevent future breakouts. There's no better time to try Proactive. Today, we're letting all listeners try Proactive 100% risk-free. Plus, they're giving away a free deep cleansing brush and free shipping when you call right now. 800-772-7610. You heard right. A risk-free trial of Proactive, a free deep cleansing brush, and free shipping. Take it from me. Proactive really works. So here's the deal again for our listeners. For $19.95, you'll get Prescription Strength Proactive, plus a deep cleansing brush valued at $55, totally free and free shipping. You're guaranteed to get clear and stay clear, or you get your money back. Call now. 800-772-7610. That's 800-772-7610. One more time. Ready? 800-772-7610.
The high winds will continue to whip across Southern California, and as Jason Capadonia reports, it only fuels a raging fire.
Forecasters originally thought that the winds would calm down by now, but they've extended the red flag warning through Sunday. Officials at the National Weather Service say wind gusts of between 40 and 60 miles per hour are expected, along with low humidity levels between 6 and 10%. The winds are fueling the fires burning currently out of control in the region, and there doesn't seem to be any major break in the near future.
Flu season is getting off to a fast start this year. The Centers for Disease Control reports widespread flu activity in seven states involving nearly 10,000 confirmed cases. Infectious disease specialists say it appears the dominant strain will be H3N2, which can cause severe illness. Experts also worry because the current vaccine was about 10% effective against the same virus during Australia's 2017 flu season. The CDC says it's always better to get a flu shot, even if this year's vaccine is not a perfect match. This is USA Radio News.
Hi, I'm Wayne Allyn Root. I was one of the biggest critics of Obama in the national media. Suddenly, I was under massive IRS attack. So I hired Sam Landis. Sam did an amazing job. We won twice. I didn't owe a penny. Thank you, Sam Landis. Many of you have IRS problems, and you've spent thousands with non-lawyer tax resolution firms. Do yourself a favor. Call Sam Landis for a free consultation. Trust me, Sam Landis is the best. Sam saved my life. Call Sam at 800-WE-HELP-YOU with the letter U. That's toll-free, 800-WE-HELP-YOU with the letter U. 800-WE-HELP-YOU.
The government's November jobs report is out, and as USA's Chris Barnes reports from Washington, it's looking pretty good.
The Labor Department reporting that the economy added 228,000 jobs in November, when economists had forecast an increase of more like 200,000. The unemployment rate at 4.1%, unchanged from October, but still the lowest it's been since the year 2000. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
Officials say the shooting at a high school in the town of Aztec, New Mexico, could have been much worse.
The Chief Hill and his crew getting there within a minute. Folks, that's fantastic. And it was because of that quick response that deterred him from shooting anybody else.
As San Juan County Sheriff Ken Christensen, he says 21-year-old William Atchison disguised himself as a student yesterday morning and entered the Aztec High School as buses were unloading. He killed cheerleader Casey Marquez and football player Francisco Fernandez. Atchison posted a message in an online forum shortly before carrying out the attack, indicating that he intended to hold a class hostage before killing himself. San Juan County Sheriff Ken Christensen doesn't believe Atchison told anyone of his plan.
How I don't think that we know so far that anyone else knew of his intentions.
He described one hero teacher who evacuated her classroom before the shooter got to it.
She's a substitute. She didn't have a key to lock the door, so she took all the kids and put them into an office area, and they barricaded the door with a couch.
I'm Ron Taylor, and this is USA Radio News.
Okay, well, we're going to talk a little bit about the weather. And, of course, I guess most people have now heard that we're expecting snow tomorrow. And
I don't think there's anybody that doesn't know we're expecting snow. My cross-country ski's out tonight.
Oh, so you don't have to work tomorrow.
Actually, I do, but I'm hoping that I can get in a couple of runs before much else happens. If we get a good bed of snow, or it gets to be before dark, I may just go out and have a little fun.
Well, I haven't heard whether or not it's going to be wet snow or dry snow. And, of course, we know if it's too wet, it's not good for cross-country skiing. And also, I'm having trouble getting the actual weather up. But I can tell you from here it is. So they were talking about hazardous conditions. I have a feeling that they consider it hazardous if there's any snow. But, in fact, there is a possibility of 3 to 5 inches tomorrow. Tonight, it could be there could be some flurries. It's going to be about 25 degrees tonight. So, of course, it will snow rather than rain. About a 40% chance of snow probably later tonight. After midnight, could be even 2 or 3 in the morning. And then, as I said, a 90% chance. I think it was 80% earlier, so now it's up to a 90% chance of snow tomorrow. And they did say by tomorrow it could be. Now, it was interesting because earlier it was a new snow accumulation, 3 to 5 inches. Now it's down to 1 to 3 inches, so it could be much less. By Sunday it should be sunny and bright, about 36 degrees, and partly sunny on Monday. Again, right around the freezing mark, could get up to about 39 degrees. And again, then we get into Monday, Tuesday, where it could be snow showers or rain. So in any event, Bill, so far we're the only sports guys here.
Well,
and
we're about 2 out of 3 means we're hitting 667, Pat. That's a good thing.
Are you on 2 or 3?
I'm on, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't get the number yet.
All right.
You can see the number. I'm on mic 3, Pat.
Okay. Well,
okay.
If you didn't hear Bill, the introduction, he's now on, and we're waiting for John Manfreda.
Well, let's hope John shows up, because if he doesn't, we still have a great show in store for you this afternoon, folks. And by the way, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and that somewhere is right here, Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce Internet Radio. I'm Bill Wolfson. My colleague, Pat Smith, is here with me, and we're going to try to keep you amused for the next hour, since we're coming up on the best time of year, Christmas, Hanukkah, and every accountant's favorite, tax season. So without
Wait. I thought you were going to say playoffs and the Super Bowl.
Well, excuse and, me.
And I thought today we might talk a little bit. I hope Bill was able to do that. But talk a little bit about, in my other program, we talked a little bit about, talked a lot about Pearl Harbor, which, of course, was 65 years yesterday. And One of the things that happened...
75 years.
Oh, you're right. It was 75 years, and I was saying 65 throughout. Couldn't believe it was that long ago. But in any event, we were talking and wanted to talk a little bit about what happened with all of sports during the Second World War, because so many of our professional sports players either joined the service voluntarily or perhaps were drafted.
That's true, Pat. Franklin Delano Roosevelt decided that the country needed a morale booster and decided that Major League Baseball would not be suspended for the duration of the war. So after Pearl Harbor, we had 4 months for the president to decide what to do. And in February, Roosevelt, being a major baseball fan, liked the idea that baseball would continue. So if some players were drafted and some players were not. And remember, it's only because of World War II and all the good players being in the service that the St. Louis Browns actually won a World Series in 1944.
Well, not only that, and I grew up, I wasn't back then, but I knew the history of the Browns. And, of course, the fact that they ended up having a midget play and a one-armed
pitcher.
So, I mean, pretty amazing. And then, of course, the other thing is women's sports.
Oh, the Women's Professional Baseball League. There's a great movie, A League of Their Own, gave us that great line, there's no crying in baseball.
That's true. That was the Tom Hanks. He was the coach.
Gina
and
Davis, Madonna, Rosie O'Donnell, cool people.
They really had a good cast in that movie.
They sure did. That was a great movie. I always think that movie is fun to watch. I look for it whenever it comes on.
Now, I've seen it a few times also, and of course, I don't think they play the historical part as much as I don't think they really let people know as to why that women's sports at that point became so important, especially the baseball.
Well, remember, you had a lot of women who left the kitchen and went to work in the factory. They became the Rosie the Riveters of the world.
Oh, absolutely. And the amazing thing to women today is that when the war ended and the men came back, they went back to the kitchen.
Not all the time. Some of them went back to classrooms because they were entitled to the GI Bill, and some of them...
Well, only if they had been in service.
That's right. And some of them stayed on at the factories because they had learned a skill. There were some pretty good welders out there who would put their hair up, put a welding mask on, and do a great job.
But on the other hand...
And, you know, that helped goose the aircraft industry in California and the electronics industry because you had women with the skills for welding and soldering, and they had the benefit. Women usually have smaller hands than men, so they were very good at doing very intricate electrical work on circuits.
Yeah, but I still say at least middle-class women, and at least in the Midwest, most of them went back home, and in fact... there were, at least in where I grew up, if you were married, you could not teach. In other words, they did not, during the war, I believe, that they made an exception of that, but...
Well, that I didn't know.
Oh, yes. My mother was a teacher, and when she was married, she had to stop teaching.
Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but I understand that that was a different age, and they had different values and different reasoning. So, but, you know, I think we live in a much more progressive, enlightened era now. But, you know, the idea of women getting into the factories and doing war work started in World War I in England, where because they drafted so many men to go to the front in France and lost so many on the Somme and Passchendaele, they were short of men. So in World War I, the Asquith government and later the government of David Lloyd George encouraged women to do factory work. Then In World War II, they had already had, starting in 1937, actually, when Britain began to realize that they just might not be able to appease Adolf Hitler. They had begun to think about factory work and beginning to think about conscription, and they made plans that if there was going to be conscription, that they would bring women into the, not just into the factories, but also onto the farm. So you might have a young lady who had grown up in London and didn't know which end of the cow the milk went in, milk came out of, and the hay went in. And she found herself in the Women's Land Army.
Well, let's talk about sports. What are some of the sports figures that we might know of who actually went into service?
Well, I'm going to talk about some of the less well-known ones and then some of the more famous ones like Yogi Berra, Bob Feller. But there was there's a very good book out, The Catcher Was a Spy, about a guy named Mo Berg who grew up in Newark. And Mo Berg was a Princeton University grad. He was multilingual. He played pro ball in the 20s and 30s and lived a life of danger as an OSS officer in Europe during World War II. And OSS was our precursor to the CIA. The one great thing they said about Mo Berg is that he, and Casey Stengel probably said it best, he could speak six languages and couldn't hit in any of them. Well, Mo Berg had a major league career of 15 unillustrious seasons on four different teams between 1923 and 1939. He never advanced beyond the position of backup catcher or substitute shortstop and rode the bench more than he played the diamond. Despite being a Princeton University grad and holding a law degree from Columbia, he got an outwardly unremarkable, somewhat mysterious life. If not for his secret exploits as a military spy during World War II, in fact, he might not be remembered today. But thanks to his work in the Office of the Strategic Services, he will go down in history. They're making a movie about his life right now called The Catcher Who Was a Spy.
Let me ask you, how
Mo
could...
Berg, one
Bill,
of the things Mo Berg was sent to do is interesting.
But... How, in what way was he a spy? What did he actually do? Wouldn't have he...
Oh, I'm
he
getting been, to that.
He would be really well known, so how could he work that successfully as a spy?
Well, first of all, Mo Berg was sent to Europe, to Switzerland, and because he spoke German so well, he was able to pass for a German, and the Office of Strategic Services told him to go out and assess the Nazis' nuclear capabilities. And some people say he was even offered to, ordered by Wild Bill Donovan, who was head of the OSS, to assassinate Werner Heisenberg, who was head of the German nuclear weapons program. Werner Heisenberg was the physicist who cooked up the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. He had a lot of influence on particle physics in the 20s and 30s. He was a contemporary of Einstein.
But let me ask you, did Mo Berg, you said he played until 1939.
Right. With the Red Sox. That was his last team.
And did he never went back to play baseball after the war?
Not that I'm aware of. Although he spoke 15 languages, including Japanese, he had two loves, baseball and spying. In Tokyo, garbed in a kimono, he took flowers to the daughter of an American diplomat being treated at St. Luke's Hospital, the tallest building in a Japanese capital, but he never delivered the flowers. He just went to the roof and photographed the harbor, the military installations, and the rail yard. And 8 years later, Colonel Jimmy Doolittle carefully studied Berg's photos in planning his spectacular raid, later called the Doolittle Raid, or in the book and the movie, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Berg's father, Bernard Berg, was a pharmacist in Newark. He taught his son Hebrew and Yiddish. Mo, against his wishes, began to play baseball on the street at the age of four. His father disapproved and never watched him play. He graduated Barringer High School in Newark, where he learned Latin, Greek, and French. He graduated magna cum laude from Princeton and added Spanish, Italian, German, and Sanskrit to the languages that he spoke. doing further studies, he picked up Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Asian, Arabic, Portuguese, and Hungarian.
That's unbelievable.
Sure. And during World War II, he even parachuted into Yugoslavia to assess the value of the war effort of the two groups of partisans there. He reported back that Marshal Tito's forces were widely supported by the people. And then Winston Churchill ordered all-out support for the Yugoslav underground fighter, Tito, rather than Mihailovic's Serbians. The parachute jump when Berg was 41 was certainly a challenge, but more was to come later that year. He went to Zurich, and one of his jobs was to, as I mentioned before, assassinate Werner Heisenberg, which he was never able to do. But he was able to attend a conference in Switzerland and another one in Germany, which was a huge risk because he was Jewish, and actually meet some of the German physicists, learn some things about their program, because he was posing as a Swiss scientist who had access to uranium. So Mo Berg ended up penniless, rootless, and very aimless in his later years. Lived with his older sister and died in 1970, and he was buried in Newark. His ashes were later exhumed, and he was moved to an unknown location in Israel. So that's the story of the catcher who was also a spy. Pretty interesting. I always like talking about war stories. Obviously, I was lucky enough to miss World War II, but I've got some more things in here. Let me get you to one that I thought was of special interest. And then, Pat, I'm going to hand these over to you for a second. This is one of the less well-known of our heroes. And then we're going to find out that there were so many of these guys who lost their lives in raids over Germany or were captured and executed. There was a guy who was a pilot in a B-17 Flying Fortress, which flew from England over Germany and France and dropped bombs. And there was a guy by the name of Stanford Wolfson, no relation that I'm aware of, who played for multiple teams in the minor leagues as a pitcher and catcher and outfielder from 1940 to 42. On October 15, 1942, he joined the Army Air Force as a bomber pilot, earning a commission as a second lieutenant. From December of 43 to November of 44, he flew 9 bombing missions over Nazi Germany. In November 5th of 1944, he flew his 10th and final mission and was ordered to bail out after the plane took heavy damage from anti-aircraft fire. Most of the crew bailed out, and Wolfson, like the rest of the crew, was picked up by the Germans. When the Germans learned Wolfson was Jewish, they shot him in the city outskirts. The suspected killer was tried by the War Crimes Tribunal at Dachau in 1947, and he himself was shot. Wolfson was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Air Medal, and the Purple Heart. So there's an interesting war story for you.
But everybody's heard of Yogi Berra, right?
Right.
There's got to be. And you probably know one of the Yogi Berra. I mean, they used to talk about things that he would say that, you know, made no sense.
Well,
but
remember, always go to other people's funerals, because otherwise they won't come
to yours. That's right. That was one.
Always like that one.
Always go to other people's funerals because they won't come to yours. But he actually made his minor league debut with the Norfolk Tars in 1943. He just played 11 games and had an impressive, really impressive slugging average. But then he got a draft card
and came in
that year and headed into the Navy. Now, I don't think they weren't drafted to the Navy, were they?
Yes, they were.
Oh, I thought they were volunteers.
My Uncle Larry was drafted into the Navy, just like other guys were drafted into the Army.
Okay, that's interesting. It was obviously before my time, but I didn't realize that they were drafted into the Navy. My father served in the Navy, but I know he volunteered.
He may have volunteered.
No,
to be
he
in
did
the Navy.
Volunteer. He was an intelligence officer. So Vera was a gunner's mate and volunteered apparently for a special mission to pilot rocket boats in front of other landing craft on D-Day.
That's right. So he was part of the crews that shelled the beach and fired rockets on the German positions.
Wasn't that June 6, 1944?
It was. And remember, June 6 was not the only day that they were off that beach. They were off that beach for about a month because it was very difficult to push inland. You know, the British who went into, I believe it is Caen, and were able to walk literally onto Sword and Juneau beaches, whereas we had a tough fight at Utah and Omaha Beach because they were higher. The Germans were entrenched there, but we managed to break out quickly afterwards. Meanwhile, the British got into the town of Caen, where the Germans fought street to street. So the British had a pretty easy landing and a tough slog getting out, and it wasn't until almost the end of July when Patton was finally landed with his Third Army in Normandy that they were able to make the famous left hook, make the drive south, and actually surround the Germans that were facing the British troops in something called the Falaise Pocket. I grew up with a kid, Sammy Cuccinello, whose dad was a tanker in Patton's army. He was a he drove a tank, and he also loaded the gun on the tank. And he told amazing stories, one of which was a little scary.
Well, I'm sure there were many, but getting back to Yogi, he went on to play major leagues and became one of the most feared batters in baseball. And he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1972, so I'm assuming that some of our viewers who went to Cooperstown certainly have, seen and heard of Yogi. And why don't we get back right after some more spots from our sponsors, and we'll be back to talk more about the sports guys.
And the sports guys who served in wars.
And the sports guys who served in wars. I mean, I think this is especially fitting after we celebrated the, and I thought it was 65th, or 66th, but now it's 76th. 76 years ago. And I guess when you think about it, most of the guys that, if they served, if they're still alive, and that's why we're losing so many of them.
They were in their
90s. They're in their 90s. Although I know that there was one code talker. Some of these guys went in and lied about their age. I know that one of the Navajo code talkers went in when he was about 15, so he was probably serving in the Pacific when he was 16, 17 years old. But in any event, let me play a few of our commercials, and we always thank our sponsors, and then we'll be back.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
This is Tony Clark, paraplanner at Patton, Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton, Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi and Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime, and selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 in Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own. Then I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process through technology to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let me show you how to take my level of professional expertise and put it to work for you in achieving your real estate goals and dreams. I can be reached at 908-238-0118. Thanks for your time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Well, we're back. The sports guys, Bill and I, are here. We're talking about... because of yesterday, of course, Pearl Harbor, and we're talking about the sports figures, some very famous, some not famous before they went in. Certainly Yogi Berra was not really famous before he served in the Second World War, but he became, as we know, he was a Hall of Famer and became an incredible, what they used to call slugger, and he really was a slugger. He did... you know, he had some, great years playing baseball. And did he ever coach?
Yogi Berra?
Right.
He managed the Mets. He managed the Yankees. He got fired for managing the Yankees by George Steinbrenner when the Yankees didn't win the World Series. And he swore he'd never go back to Yankee Stadium again. And then 20 years later, after managing the Mets... George Steinbrenner invited him back, and they kind of made up.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, he grew up in St. Louis in an Italian neighborhood, and, you know, his parents didn't know anything about baseball. But apparently the local American Legion League set him on the path that would take him to the Hall of Fame. So isn't that interesting, You know, ordinarily he would not have been, you know, he was probably, his parents were probably first generation, and, you know, they really didn't have baseball in Italy, so they wouldn't have known much about it. But one of the things that I have a question about, maybe you know the answer, maybe you don't, or maybe some of our listeners do, we now know that where American soldiers served, they played baseball as a hobby. And so that, for example, I don't know when they started playing in the Dominican Republic, but, you know, people often say, well, why are there so many baseball players from the Dominican Republic? Well, that was one of the places where American soldiers were stationed.
Oh, sure.
And that's where the kids learned baseball.
But remember, American soldiers invaded the Dominican Republic before World War I and brought baseball there with them. It was a very popular
game. So it was that early?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Dominican Republic is almost like a baseball player factory.
No, no, I know it is, but I didn't know when that started. So you're saying that goes back before World War II?
Oh, yeah, way before. And then the same thing with Cuba. In Cuba, where after the Spanish-American War, Cuba was almost like an American colony. We spent a lot of time and effort and money supporting the sugar industry there, but we also eradicated malaria, which was then called yellow fever. We had soldiers digging wells and putting in sewer systems and dealing with sanitation. And it was a, Cuba was a major rehabilitation project up until we got involved in World War I. We actually established a legislature, gave people the right to vote. Our track record in Cuba before World War I was actually pretty good compared to what the Spanish had done to them.
Well, that doesn't, you know, surprise me. But that's interesting that because, of course, in countries where there wasn't a big military presence, for example, in Guatemala, baseball was not a big sport. It was soccer.
But yet, and of course, Nicaragua, they play baseball.
And but Mexico, not so much, right? I mean, that's always been a big soccer.
Oh, there are the Mexican leagues. In fact, Bob Feller jumped to one of the Mexican leagues when he couldn't get Cleveland to pay him. Satchel Paige pitched in the Mexican leagues because he was a black guy and he could get more money than playing in the Negro leagues because he was that good of a pitcher.
Oh, he was an amazing pitcher.
He certainly was. I have met two or three people who claim to have watched him pitch. Obviously, these were much older men, and who knows whether they were really telling me the true story or making up a fish story. That's like, I've had two guys tell me that they were in Hershey, Pennsylvania the night Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points back in the 50s. And, you know, I begin thinking to myself, you know, I know where that arena is in Hershey. And if all the people were there who claimed they were there, it's got to be bigger than Beaver Stadium.
Yeah. Kind of like Woodstock. Yeah. Well, the other person that I wanted to talk about a little bit, well, we still have we do have time, is Bob Feller, and of course, there was a chapter in a book by Alan Schwarz, I think that book about 2006, and it was the book was Once Upon a Game, Baseball's Greatest Memories. And so that at that point, what was said is everybody talked about him, and they called him Rapid Robert for his fastball, but he also reflected on his decision to enlist in the Navy during World War II, and as a result, he missed almost four seasons of Major League Baseball. And then Feller, of course, died, and I don't recall. I think he was like 92 years old before he died, but according to him, he said that.
Well, what did they say?
I'm sorry, there was my phone that went off. He said he was driving his new Buick Century across the Mississippi River, that would be the Iowa-Illinois state line, when his world and probably almost everyone's world changed forever. So, of course, he was talking about December 7th, 1941. And he was driving to a meeting with his Cleveland Indians bosses to hash out a 1942 contract. And he heard this over the radio. The Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And, you know, it's interesting. Everyone that I've ever talked to who was probably more than 4 years old on December 7th, 1941, remembers exactly where they were and what they were doing when they heard this news. And apparently when it was first announced, they had to tell everybody that it wasn't a joke. And I suppose that might have been, was that after the Orson Welles? When did that happen? Because
The Orson Welles program about
War of the Worlds?
War of the Worlds happened in 1936.
Okay, so then that makes... That,
and that's a, there's a very vivid family story about that.
Well, but see, now that makes sense as to why when they started announcing that, apparently they said that it was not a joke. And also, just a few minutes, there was some transmission from Hawaii, just a few minutes of really announcing over the radio there that was picked up here in the United States before it was cut off. But that would be the, you know, I can understand why whoever the announcer was had to say this isn't a joke, because people would say, oh, that's another thing like War of the Worlds. But in any event, everyone I ever talked to, including now we know Mr. Feller, realized where they were. And he said at that point, the last thing on his mind after he heard that was to play baseball. And he immediately decided to enlist in the United States Navy. He said he didn't have to, actually. He was 23 years old and strong-bodied. But along with his father being terminally ill in Iowa, he would have been exempt from military service. He said he wanted to join the fight against Hitler and the Japanese, and we were losing that war, and most young men of his generation wanted to help push them back. And that was very interesting, because that's true. And in fact, you know, I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. Now, even years after the war, because when I start remembering, the veterans were proud, and it was almost an embarrassment for somebody who had not served.
Oh, that's very true. My father had a friend who is actually one of my godfathers, Ben Birch. Ben Birch barely made it into the Army because he was 6'6". And if you were taller than 6'6", you couldn't be in the Army. I guess they didn't have uniforms big enough for you. But Mr. Birch, who was a very gentle, nice man, kind of took a shine to me when I was a little kid, because he and his wife had three daughters, and my dad, one of his close friends, had a son and then another son, my brother. And one day I was in my 20s and we were talking, and Ben Birch was in the infantry, and he was in D-Day, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was in the Battle in Hurtgen Forest.
Well, then he was very lucky. He made it from 1941 through Battle of the Bulge, which was late. It was winter 44,
winter
45.
44, yeah. Late winter of 44.
Late winter, it, 44. But it continued into 45.
Well, by New Year's Day 1945, the Germans had run out of gasoline, and they were abandoning their tanks and their armored personnel carriers and retreating. They had kind of shot their bolt. The Germans had scraped up as many tanks and as much fuel as they could get, and I think it left the door open to them for the Russians to fight them a little bit harder, because at that point they were pretty much depleted.
So anyway, with Feller, when he joined, you know, he said that people later on didn't understand, because he was making $100,000 a year with the Indians, and he became the first professional athlete to join the Navy after Pearl Harbor. So he
said, "I didn't know that." I didn't know, really.
He said it was one of the greatest experiences of his life. You know, you can talk about teamwork on a baseball team, but he said that the takes teamwork when you have 2,900 men stationed on a battleship, and that would have been a battleship because he was on the USS Alabama.
Any ship that was named after a state was a battleship.
Yep. Right. I mean, I learned that recently from my husband. So he was in the South Pacific. He was a chief petty officer and helped give exercises and ran the baseball team. So here again, he ran the baseball team and recreation when they were in port. So this is, again, anybody anywhere they were in port would see these American young men playing baseball. He said he was also a gun captain, and he was firing a 40-millimeter quad at 8 rounds per second. So, you know, he wasn't just somebody who's in there, you know, playing sports.
And pushing a pencil.
Yeah, and that's the same thing that many Hollywood actors, the same thing. But in any event, he said the Alabama was involved in one of the most important battles of the Pacific. And that was in June of 1944. They were supposed to shell the beaches of Saipan for 2 hours so that our Marines could land safely. And the Japanese tried a surprise attack, but they were ready, and the American Navy and Air Force, they had all the big carriers and battleships like the Iowa, the Wisconsin, the New Jersey, the Alabama, and they had them all there. Their pilots and gunners shot down 474 Japanese aircraft. And I guess that was in somewhat of a reprisal of what the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor. And they said then, after that, they got several of their carriers and several of their escort ships. And then the sun went down that night. It was the end of the Japanese naval forces. So at that point, they said that it was so easy that ever since they've called it the Great Marianas
Turkey Shoot.
Turkey Shoot.
Sure.
Good for you. You really know much more about this than I did. So he said they were also involved in many other important engagements, including some in the North Atlantic over Europe. Well, that surprises me. I didn't realize that some of the Pacific Fleet would also go into the North Atlantic.
Oh, yeah. Then remember, we had convoys going to Britain and from Britain to Russia. We also had convoys going to places like Iceland and Greenland and also to places like Newfoundland and Nova Scotia because it was critical because that's how you couldn't fly a B-17 all that far because they simply did not have the capacity to fly all the way across the Atlantic, so they would literally hop from one to another, and they would get to the point where if they were over Greenland, they knew they had to have, and they were in fog, they were in trouble because everything was dead reckoning navigation. The electronic navigation was in its infancy. And they would have to follow these radio beams and line them up in order to find an airport in a fog. And very often planes would run out of fuel and just crash into the ocean and be lost. Other times they would bring these planes over on ships and they would be in crates. And when they got them to Liverpool or Manchester or some of the other western ports in England, they would offload them. And put them on train cars, get them to factories, and uncrate them and put the wings on and the wheels on and assemble them. And we had to design airplanes that could be put together quickly, just like the British had to figure out as they went from one version to the next of their fighters and bombers and seaplanes, how they could...
assemble these airplanes quickly and get them onto the flight line so they could go into combat.
Well, that and they were losing so many of them, of course. But apparently, Feller, he went inactive in August of 1945, but said that because he had stayed in good shape and had played baseball on military teams, he was ready to start for the Indians just a couple days later. And so the first game he played was against the Tigers, and he said that more than 47,000 people came to see him return. And there was such a patriotic feeling with VJ Day so fresh in everyone's minds. So then he said, even though he had not pitched in the major leagues in almost 4 years, he struck out the first batter and wound up...
That must have felt great.
Yeah, wound up throwing a four-hitter and won the game 4-2. And apparently then for the rest of the season... And I guess the next season, 1946, was one of his best. He won 26 games in 1946 with 348 strikeouts. Now, you tell me, since you're such a baseball fan, how does that compare to pitchers today?
Well, remember, the competition was better because each league only had eight teams, so... And there was no interleague play. So I think the records that guys like Bob Feller had or Willie Mays had are head and shoulders above what's being accomplished today.
Well, and also, I grew up Chicago Cubs, and then when the Braves came to Milwaukee, we were Braves fans. And these guys played almost the entire game. I mean, unless they were not doing well, that these pitchers were in there pitching the entire game.
Sure, you might note that a very famous Braves pitcher, Warren Spahn, fought in the Battle of the Bulge.
Well, and Warren Spahn, of course, I remember him pitching for the Braves.
Sure.
And as I said, I don't remember that they were officially closers. I certainly know there weren't openers and
we have
everything.
A John Manfreda sighting. How are you, sir?
And he probably remembers World War II. He's such an old geezer.
Well, you never know. John remembers a lot of things. He remembered to show up today.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We've been
actually good evening, I guess, at this point.
Remembers who's starting for the Giants this weekend.
I don't know, some guy named Manning won a couple of Super Bowls. I think he's going to be in
so
there.
Too.
Is he good? We've been talking about...
We've been talking about baseball players who fought in World War II.
Yeah. So we were just talking about something because of yesterday being, the day of infamy when Pearl Harbor was struck. I guess you may or may not remember that day. I think you were probably not around, like most of us.
Wasn't around, but I can't say I remember it, but I'm certainly aware of it and grew up listening about it from my dad, who was in the San Diego Naval Base at the time of the attack. And
was in the Navy before.
My dad was an engineering student at the time and was in fire control on it, being trained for the actually spent most of the first part of the war in the Pensacola top secret facility figuring out how to eliminate the German submarines. So if you notice, remember at the start of the war, the North Atlantic was filled with German submarines and all of a sudden they were gone? Well, my dad was a part of a team that figured out how to get rid of the subs.
Well, remember, there are sunken German submarines off of the New Jersey coast.
In fact, there's one right by the Cape May Lighthouse that you can see. Which,
well, I didn't know you could actually see
it. Yeah, when you up to the top of the lighthouse, you look down, you can see the sub in the water.
Was that close? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And believe it or not, this sounds like a joke, like cement galoshes. There's actually a submarine made of cement. That's a little weird. That didn't win, but that was the design. But yeah. So what about? No question. You can reminisce on December 7th. How are you guys relating that to the sports scene?
Well, we're talking about the sports guys.
Are you talking about the Giants season? How they've just been?
We're talking about the sports figures.
We're talking about all the athletes
who
got drafted and served.
Oh.
Or volunteer.
Well, I mean, I don't know about World War One, but, you know, Ted Williams is the guy that stands out to me. He gave up 5 years in the prime of his career.
World War II.
That was
and
Korea,
the Korean
and
War.
World War and the Korean War.
Yeah, but so did Feller. Gave up.
What's that again?
Feller gave up four.
Yep, yep.
And,
but my point is, when you're talking
dollars.
About all-time greats, and you look at Ted Williams with 521
right.
homers, who was out for 5 years in his prime, assuming that he might have hit 25 homers to 30 homers, that yeah, he would have been closing on that seven. He certainly would have been higher on the home run list, but in my view, you know, again, one of the top five greatest players of all time.
Oh, I agree. And yes, you're right, because, well, but look at somebody like Bob Feller and what his statistics might have been. And, of course, we do have Yogi Berra, who, you know, Hall of Famer, and then, of course, some other...
What did Berra fight in World War II?
Yes, he was in the Navy.
Okay. I didn't know that.
I think he was drafted. But
wow.
In any event, I guess we can spend a couple minutes talking about... the current season and so Eli Manning is now going to be starting?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to start him, and I think they're going to just see how things go the last couple of games in terms of whether they got a look at Geno Smith. And, you know, I think what everybody would like to see is this third-round pick, Webb, to see if he has anything. But it almost has become moot now because it's – almost any way you slice this, it looks like the Giants are going to have at worst the third pick. And they're eyeing Donaldson, who most people seem to believe is the better of the three big quarterbacks, a bit like a Jared Goff with a big arm and that kind of thing. And the question is, if they did have the third pick, what they would have to give the Browns to relinquish him, because Donaldson has not come out and said he won't play for Cleveland, but they anticipate that there's going to be pushback there that, you know, don't draft me because I'm not showing up. And,
well, what about Rosen at UCLA?
Yeah, I think he's in the conversation. But I think, you know, USC and UCLA, when's the last time their programs really produced a top flight quarterback? They, you know, you think of
Mark Sanchez.
They all suffered. Look at Leinart, Sanchez. They were all drafted in the top five or ten. And the problem is these guys tend to be the products of an excellent system more so than have great raw talent themselves. They just have not had successful NFL quarterbacks come out of those programs. And I think that Rosen will suffer a little bit because of that. I think he may still be a top ten pick. I don't think he's a Giants pick.
Well, you know, we're down to the last 2 minutes, folks. And I wanted to talk just a little bit about the next couple of weeks. I know that we'll be here next Friday. I don't know if we're going to be here the Friday of Christmas weekend.
No, we've decided not.
The 2 weeks from today, no, I don't believe
Christmas
so.
Christmas is 2 weeks from today, pretty much, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
And I have begun lining up some of our guests for our winter extravaganza.
Some hockey folks, I hope.
Well, we'll get there. For those of you who have New Year's resolutions you'd like to make, we're going to be bringing on somebody from HealthQuest. And then a week later, we're going to hopefully have a guy who is a coach and trainer who to inspire us not to break our New Year's resolutions and to make sure we get to the gym and get our exercise despite the weather. Then, for those of us who have gotten drones for Christmas or Hanukkah, I'm going to ask a guy from a drone academy to come in and show us how to fly drones.
That's
a sport.
I'm sure it is.
It's sure it's becoming a sport.
Like the model airplanes? And absolutely.
Bet. You bet.
Yeah.
Well, just
and
so
then,
we don't forget, you know, our football, although...
Oh,
unless
we'll work. Pat, I promise you we're going to work that in. Meanwhile, for those of you with the... who are swashbucklers at heart, I'm lining up someone from the Bucks County Academy of Fencing over in Lambertville. And for those of you who love Errol Flynn as Robin Hood, the archery school also in Lambertville. And we've got some others, you know, in the pot.